Chapter 4. 1. Stamford. The old Indian captured above having promised to lead us to Wetscheck, which consisted of 3 castles. 65 men were dispatched under Baxter and Piotr Cock, who found them empty, though 30 Indians could have stood against 200 soldiers since the castles were constructed of plank 5 inches thick 9 feet high, and braced around with thick bark full of portholes. Our people burnt too, reserving the third for a retreat. Marching 8 or 9 leagues further, they discovered nothing but some huts, which they could not surprise as they were discovered. They came back having killed only 1 or 2 Indians, taken some women and children prisoners and burnt much corn. Meanwhile we were advised that Penwitz, one of the oldest and most experienced Indians in the country, and who in the first conspiracy had given the most dangerous advice, to wit, that they should wait and not attack the Dutch until all suspicion had been lulled, and then divide themselves equally through the houses of the Christians and slaughter all these in one night, was secretly waging war against us with his tribe, who killed some of our people and set fire to the houses. It was therefore resolved to send thither a troop of 120 men. The burghers under their company, the English under the Sergeant Major Van der Hyl-II, who within a few days had offered his services and was accepted, the veteran soldiers under Piotr Cock, all under the command of Mr. Lamontin, proceed hence in 3 yachts, land in Scouts Bay on Long Island, 3, and march towards HEMSTEDE 4, where there is an English colony dependent on us. Some sent forward in advance dexterously killed an Indian who was out as a spy. Our force was divided into 2 divisions, Van der Hill with 14 English towards the smallest, and 80 men towards the largest village named Matsup, 5 both which were very successful, killing about 120 men. Of ours 1 man remained on the field and 3 were wounded. 1 chief of the Canarsie tribe, in western Long Island. 2 John Underhill, whose unctuous piety and profligate life have an important place in Winthrop and other New England historians. With Captain John Mason he had the leading part in the crushing of the Pequots in 1637. Banished from Massachusetts and restored, this amusing reprobate had gone to the Dutch, having good offers made him by the Dutch governor, he speaking the Dutch tongue, and his wife a Dutch woman, but had now settled at Stamford. Later he lived at Flushing, and at Oyster Bay, where he died in 1672. 3 now called Manhasset Bay. 4 now Hempstead, Long Island, where early in 1644 Robert Fordham and other English from Stamford had formed a colony under New Netherland jurisdiction. 5 Mesbath, now Newtown, Long Island. 6 Stamford. Our forces being returned from this expedition, Captain Van der Hill was dispatched to Stamford, 1 to get some information there of the Indians. He reported that the guide who had formerly served us, and was supposed to have gone astray in the night, had now been in great danger of his life among the Indians, of whom there were about 500 together. He offered to lead us there, to shew that the former mischance was not his fault. 130 men were accordingly dispatched under the aforesaid General Van der Hill and Hendrik Van Dyck, ensign. They embarked in 3 yachts, and landed at Greenwich, where they were obliged to pass the night by reason of the great snow and storm. In the morning they marched northwest up over stony hills over which some must creep. In the evening about 8 o'clock they came within a league of the Indians, and inasmuch as they should have arrived too early, and had to cross 2 rivers, 1 of 200 feet wide and 3 deep, and that the men could not afterwards there rest in consequence of the cold, it was determined to remain there until about 10 o'clock. The order was given, as to the mode, to be observed in attacking the Indians they marched forward towards the houses, the latter being set up in 3 rows, street fashion, each row 80 paces long, in a low recess protected by the hills, affording much shelter from the northwest wind. The moon was then at the full, and threw a strong light against the hills, so that many winter days were not brighter than it then was. On arriving there, the Indians were wide awake and on their guard, so that ours determined to charge and surround the houses, sword in hand. They demeaned themselves as soldiers and deployed in small bands, so that we got in a short time 1 dead and 12 wounded. They were also so hard-pressed that it was impossible for one to escape. In a brief space of time there were counted 180 dead outside the houses. Presently none durst come forth, keeping within the houses, discharging arrows through the holes. The general perceived that nothing else was to be done, and resolved with Sergeant Major Van der Hill to set the huts on fire, whereupon the Indians tried every means of escape, not succeeding, in which they returned back to the flames, preferring to perish by the fire than to die by our hands. What was most wonderful is that among this vast collection of men, women, and children not one was heard to cry or to scream. According to the report of the Indians themselves, the number then destroyed exceeded 500. Some say, full 700, among whom were also 25 Wappingers, our God having collected together there the greater number of our enemies, to celebrate one of their festivals in their manner, from which escaped no more than 8 men in all, and 3 of them were severely wounded. The fight ended, several fires were built in consequence of the great cold. The wounded, 15 in number, among whom was the general, were dressed, and the sentinels being posted, the troops bivouacked there for the remainder of the night. On the next day, the party set out very early in good order, so as to arrive at Stanford in the evening. They marched with great courage over that wearisome range of hills, God affording extraordinary strength to the wounded, some of whom were badly hurt, and came in the afternoon to Stanford after a march of 2 days, and 1 night and little rest. The English received our people in a very friendly manner, affording them every comfort. In 2 days they reached here. A thanksgiving was proclaimed on their arrival. The remainder is wanting. 1 Stamford. End of Project Gutenberg et Text Ornel of New Netherland. Begin Project Gutenberg et Text, a presentation of New Netherland. Reference material and sources. Adrian van der Donk, The Representation of New Netherland, 1650. And J. Franklin Jamison, ed. Narratives of New Netherland, 1609-1664, Original Narratives of Early American History, New York. Charles Scribner's Sons, 1909. Introduction, The Fussy Incompetence of Kieft, and the disastrous results of the Indian War he had aroused led at last to his removal, and in May, 1647, a new Director General arrived. Petrus Stuyvesant, who had made a good record as governor of Curacao in the West Indies. Stuyvesant, the last of the Dutch governors, was a man of character, brave, honest, capable, and energetic. But he was proud, headstrong and tyrannical, and had such high notions of a governor's prerogative, that from the first he conceived a prejudice against the opponents of Kieft, and presently Kuyter and Mellon were condemned to severe punishment for attempting to bring the latter to justice. The new Director General was bent on pursuing a vigorous policy toward encroaching English and Swedish neighbors, on repressing the high claims of the patroon's officers at Rensselaerswyck, on putting the province in good condition for defense, on suppressing illegal trading, especially the supplying of firearms to the Indians, and on regulating with a strong hand all the doings of his small body of subjects. But such a policy costs money, and to obtain it by taxation he found himself compelled in August, 1647, like many another arbitrary ruler, to summon reluctantly the representatives of the people. Carefully as the functions of the 9 men were limited, they constituted a permanent element in the governmental system, as the 12 men and 8 men had not. It was inevitable that sooner or later they should become the mouthpiece of popular discontent, which was rapidly increasing under the unprosperous condition of the province and the burdensome taxes, customs and other restrictions imposed upon its economic life. In December, 1648, the board was partly renewed. One of the new members, Adrian van der Donk, a lawyer from Breda, who from 1641 to 1646 had been shout for the Patroonate Rensselaerwyck, soon became the leading spirit of the new board. Their sense of popular grievances increasing, they planned to send a deputation to the mother country to remonstrate. Stuyvesant opposed, arrested van der Donk, seized some of his papers, and expelled him from the board. Nevertheless, a bold memorial to the States General was prepared, and was signed on July 26, 1649, in the name, and on the behalf of the Commonalty of New Netherland, by van der Donk and 10 others, present or former members of the Board of 9 Men. In this memorial, which is printed in documents relating to the colonial history of New York, I-259-261, the representatives request the Dutch government to enact measures for the encouragement of emigration to the province, to grant suitable municipal or civil government, somewhat resembling the laudable government of the fatherland, to accord greater economic freedom, and to settle with foreign governments those disputes respecting colonial boundaries and jurisdiction, the constant agitation of which so unsettled the province and impeded its growth. The following document accompanied the memorial, bearing date 2 days later, July 28, 1649, and was signed by the same 11 men. It is considered probable that Adrian van der Donk was its main author. Its first part, descriptive of the province, reads like a preliminary sketch for his Beschrijving van New Netherland, Description of New Netherland, a very interesting work published at Amsterdam 6 years later, 1665, second edition 1656, and of which a translation appears in the collections of the New York Historical Society, second series, I-125-242. With respect to the remaining, or political portion of its contents, it is only fair for the reader to remember that it is a body of ex parte statements, and should be compared with those made on behalf of the administration by Secretary Van Tienhoven in his answer, the document immediately following this. Stuyvesant, whatever his faults of temper, love of autocratic power, lack of sympathy with the life of a community already far from austere, vindictiveness even conceived of his province as a political community, not solely as a commercial possession, and honestly tried to govern it with an eye to its own best interest. The directors, moreover, could truthfully say that many of their narrowest actions were prescribed by their instructions from the West India Company. While the States General were often capable of taking a statesmanlike view of New Netherland, and as it lost control of the former, found itself involved in greater and greater financial embarrassments, which made it increasingly difficult to do justice to the latter. We may also set down on the credit side of the account that though the administration was slow to concede representative institutions to the province, it did not a little to organize local self-government, keep granting village rights, with magistrates and local courts of justice, to Hampstead in 1644, to Flushing in 1645. To Brooklyn in 1646, while Stuyvesant bestowed such rights on a dozen towns during his 17 years' rule, and gave New Amsterdam a somewhat restricted municipal government in 1653. Of those whose signatures follow van der Donk's at the end of the representation, Augustin Herman was a Bohemian of Prague, who had served in Wallenstein's army, had come out to New Netherland in 1633 as agent of a mercantile house of Amsterdam, and had become an influential merchant. A man of various accomplishments, he probably made the drawing of New Amsterdam, which is reproduced at the foot of van der Donk's map in this volume. Later he made for Lord Baltimore a fine map of Maryland, and received as his reward the princely estate of Bohemia Manor. Arnoldus van Hardenberg, another merchant, had been a victim of judicial oppression by both Kieft and Stuyvesant. Jacob van Coenhoven had come out in 1633, and resided at first at Rensselaerwyck. He was afterward of note as speculator and brewer in New Amsterdam. Olaf Stevens van Cortlandt had been storekeeper for the company and deacon of the church. Later he was burgomaster of New Amsterdam. Michiel Jansz and Thomas Hall were farmers, the latter, the first English settler in New York State, having come to Manhattan as a deserter from George Holmes' abortive expedition of 1635 against Fort Nassau on South River. Elbert Ellerts was a weaver, Hendrik Kip a tailor. Govert Lukermans, on the other hand, brother-in-law to both Kewentoven and Cortlandt, was the chief merchant and Indian trader of the province, often in partnership with Isaac Allerton, the former pilgrim of Plymouth. Lastly, Jan Evert Spout, a farmer, had formerly been superintendent for Powat Pavonia. Characterizations of these men, by an unfriendly hand, may be seen at the end of Van Tientoven's answer to this representation. Three of the signers, Van der Donk, Kewentoven, and Bout, were deputed to go to the Netherlands and present the representation to the States General, while Stuyvesant sent Secretary Van Tientoven to counteract their efforts. The voluminous papers which both parties presented to their High Mightinesses were referred to a committee, which in April, 1650, submitted a draft of a reformed and more liberal government for the province. The delegates caused their representation to be printed in a pamphlet of 49 pages, now very rare, under the title, Vertu van New Nederland. Wegens de Gelegenheid, Verstreerheid, en Sobrenstiet des Hofs Hague, 1650, i.e. representation of New Netherland, concerning its location, productiveness and poor condition. Much discussion was aroused. He name of New Netherland, wrote the Amsterdam Chamber of the Company to Stuyvesant, was scarcely ever mentioned before, and now it would seem as if heaven and earth were interested in it. So effective an exposition of the colony's value, and of its misgovernment, could not fail to awaken consideration and sympathy. Nevertheless, the company, aided by the answer which Van Tientoven submitted in November, 1650, were able to ride out the storm, and to temporize until the outbreak of the War of 1652-1654 with England put a new face on colonial affairs. A few concessions were made, the export duty on tobacco was taken off, and a municipal government allowed to New Amsterdam, now a town of 700 or 800 inhabitants, 1653, but no serious alteration in the provincial government resulted. Our Grand Duke of Muscovy, wrote one of Stuyvesant's subordinates to Van der Donk, keeps on as of old. Disaffection among the Dutch settlers never ceased till the English conquest, though on the other hand the English settlers on Long Island were much better disposed towards Stuyvesant's government, and were treated by him with more favor. Van der Donk's two companions returned to New Netherland before long. He, however, remained in the old country until the summer of 1653, occupied with the business of his mission, with legal studies, taking the degree of Doctor of Laws at the University of Leiden, and with the preparation of his Bescherwinch van Nieuws-Nederland. The States General gave him a copyright for it in May, 1653, but the first edition was not published till 1655. In that year the author died, leaving to his widow his estate, or colony, which he called Kalending. The name of Yonkers, where it was situated, perpetuates his title of gentility, Jonkheer van der Donk. The original manuscript of the representation is still preserved in the archives of the Netherlands, and a translation of it was printed in 1856 in Documents Relating to the Colonial History of New York, I-271-318, and reprinted in Pennsylvania Archives, 2nd Series, V-124-170. A translation of the printed tract, the text of which differs, but very slightly from that of the manuscript, was made by Hon. Henry C. Murphy and printed in 1849 in the collections of the New York Historical Society, 2nd Series, 2. 251-329. It exists also in a separate form as a pamphlet, and, combined with the Breidenreit, in a volume privately printed in an edition of 125 copies by Mr. James Lennox. It is this translation which, revised by Professor A. Clinton Crowell, is printed in the following pages. The Representation of New Netherland, 1650, The Representation of New Netherland Concerning Its Location, Productiveness, and Poor Condition. Among all the people in the world, industrious in seeking out foreign lands, navigable waters and trade, those who bear the name of Netherlanders, will very easily hold their place with the first, as is sufficiently known to all those who have in any wise saluted the threshold of history, and as will also be confirmed by the following relation. The country of which we propose to speak, was first discovered in the year of our Lord 1609, by the ship Half Moon, of which Hendrick Hudson was master, and supercargo at the expense of the Chartered East India Company, though in search of a different object. It was subsequently called New Netherland by our people, and very justly, as it was first discovered and possessed by Netherlanders, and at their cost. So that even at the present day, those natives of the country who are so old, as to recollect when the Dutch ships first came here, declare that when they saw them, they did not know what to make of them, and could not comprehend whether they came down from heaven, or were of the devil. Some among them, when the first one arrived, even imagined it to be a fish, or some monster of the sea, and accordingly a strange report of it spread over the whole land. We have also heard the savages frequently say, that they knew nothing of any other part of the world, or any other people than their own, before the arrival of the Netherlanders. For these reasons, therefore, and on account of the similarity of climate, situation, and fertility, this place is rightly called New Netherland. It is situated on the northerly coast of America, in the latitude of 38, 39, 40, 41 and 42 degrees, or thereabouts, coastwise. It is bounded on the northeast by New England, and on the southwest by Virginia. The coast runs nearly southwest and northeast, and is washed by the ocean. On the north, is the River of Canada, a large river running far into the interior. The northwest side is still partially unknown. The land is naturally fruitful, and capable of supporting a large population, if it were judiciously allotted according to location. The air is pleasant here, and more temperate than in the Netherlands. The winds are changeable, and blow from all points, but generally from the southwest and northwest, the former prevailing in summer, and the latter in winter, at times very sharply, but constituting, nevertheless, the greatest blessing to the country as regards the health of the people, for being very strong and pure, it drives far inland, or consumes all damps and superfluous moisture. The coast is generally clean and sandy, the beach detached and broken into islands. Eastward from the North River lies Long Island, about 40 leagues in length, forming a fine wide river, which falls at either end into the ocean, and affording a very convenient passage between the shores, which is protected from the dangers of the sea by a great number of good bays and other places of anchorage, so that vessels even in winter can readily pass east and west. Towards the south, approaching the South River, there are several inlets, but they are muddy and sandy, though after proper experiments they could be used. Inside these again there are large streams and meadows, but the waters are for the most part shallow. Along the seacoast the land is generally sandy or gravelly, not very high, but tolerably fertile, so that for the most part it is covered over with beautiful trees. The country is rolling in many places, with some high mountains, and very fine flats and maize lands, together with large meadows, salt and fresh, all making very fine hay land. It is overgrown with all kinds of trees, standing without order, as in other wildernesses, except that the maize lands, plains and meadows have few or no trees, and these with little pains, might be made into good arable land. The seasons are the same as in the Netherlands, but the summer is warmer, and begins more suddenly. The winter is cold, and further inland, or towards the most northerly part, colder than in the Netherlands. It is also subject to much snow, which remains long on the ground, and in the interior, 3, 4, and 5 months, but near the seacoast it is quickly dissolved by the southerly winds. Thunder, lightning, rain, showers, hail, snow, frost, dew and the like, are the same as in the Netherlands, except that in the summer sudden gusts of wind are somewhat more frequent. The land is adapted to the production of all kinds of winter and summer fruits, and with less trouble and tilling than in the Netherlands. It produces different kinds of woods, suitable for building houses and ships, whether large or small, consisting of oaks of various kinds, as post oak, white smooth bark, white rough bark, gray bark, black bark, and still another kind which they call, from its softness, butter oak, the poorest of all, and not very valuable. The others, if cultivated as in the Netherlands, would be equal to any Flemish or Brabant oaks. It also yields several species of nut wood, in great abundance, such as oil nuts, large and small, walnut of different sizes, in great abundance, and good for fuel, for which it is much used, and chestnut, the same as in the Netherlands, growing in the woods without order. There are 3 varieties of beech: water beech, common beech, and hedge beech, also axe handle wood, 2 species of canoe wood, ash, birch, pine, fir, juniper or wild cedar, linden, alder, willow, thorn, elder, and many other kinds useful for many purposes, but unknown to us by name, and which we will be glad to submit to the carpenters for further examination. The indigenous fruits consist principally of acorns, some of which are very sweet, nuts of different kinds, chestnuts, beech nuts, but not many mulberries, plums, medlars, wild cherries, black currants, gooseberries, hazelnuts in great quantities, small apples, abundant strawberries throughout the country, with many other fruits and roots which the savages use. There is also plenty of bilberries or blueberries, together with groundnuts and artichokes, which grow underground. Almost the whole land is full of vines, in the wild woods as well as on the maize lands and flats. But they grow principally near to and upon the banks of the brooks, streams and rivers, which are numerous, and run conveniently and pleasantly everywhere, as if they were planted there. The grapes comprise many varieties, some white, some very fleshy, and only fit to make raisins of, others on the contrary juicy, some are very large and others small. The juice is pleasant, and some of it as white as French or Rhenish wine. Some is a very deep red, like tent, one and some is paler. The vines run much on the trees, and are shaded by their leaves, so that the grapes ripen late, and are a little sour. But with the intelligent assistance of man, as fine wines would undoubtedly be made here as in any other country. In regard to other fruits, all those which grow in the Netherlands also grow very well in New Netherland, without requiring as much care to be bestowed upon them as is necessary there. Garden fruits succeed very well, yet are drier, sweeter, and more agreeable than in the Netherlands. For proof of which we may easily instance muskmelons, citrons, or watermelons, 2 which in New Netherland grow right in the open fields, if the briars and weeds are kept from them, while in the Netherlands they require the close care of amateurs, or those who cultivate them for profit in gardens, and then they are neither so perfect by far, nor so palatable, as they are in New Netherland. In general all kinds of pumpkins, and the like are also much drier, sweeter and more delicious, which is caused by the temperateness and amenity of the climate. The tame cattle are in size, and other respects about the same as in the Netherlands, but the English cattle and swine thrive and grow best, appearing to be better suited to the country than those from Holland. They require, too, less trouble, expense and attention, for it is not necessary in winter to look after such as are dry, or the swine, except that in the time of a deep snow they should have some attention. Milch cows also are much less trouble than they are in Holland, as most of the time, if any care be requisite, it is only for the purpose of giving them occasionally a little hay. The wild animals are principally lions, three but they are few, bears, of which there are many, elks and deer in great numbers, some of which are entirely white, and others wholly black. The savages say that the white deer are of very great consequence in the estimation of the other deer, and are exceedingly beloved, regarded and honored by the others, but that the reverse is true of the black deer. There are various other large animals in the interior, but they are unknown to the Christians. There are also wolves, dangerous only to small cattle, beavers, otters, weasels, wild cats, foxes, raccoons, minks, hares, muskrats, about as large as cats, polecats and squirrels, some of which can fly. There are Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.